Warning: some content discussed in this podcast can be triggering to survivors of sexual assault and difficult to hear. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the My House Podcast, a show about the past, present, and future goings-on at the My House Youth Drop-In Center in Wasilla, Alaska, with your host, Michelle Overstreet.
Welcome to episode 67 of the My House Podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Overstreet, and today I'm joined by Kristen Cole. Kristen, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my honor.
You're nationally famous with a huge real estate network and a charity that has done amazing things for us and for many, many community members. I know you support Adult and Teen Challenge, and you have a lot of heartfelt places that you direct donations. So thank you for picking us. Your donations in the last 18 months have allowed us to continue to build our programs to go into that big building over there, that $23 million building. And we had zero support from any foundation or any funder across the entire Northwest. And you were the person that stepped forward and said, I'm going to make sure that this continues to go forward. So thank you for that. It was we were close to the wheels coming off, and you just said, I got this. So
we were happy to make it happen. As you know, I'm pretty passionate about it.
We traveled to Scottsdale, Arizona last January for a fundraiser. And you shared a story that a lot of the people that you have mentored and worked with for years and years did not know.
Yeah, that was tough. It was tough to be that vulnerable. You know, oftentimes when someone has some success, most of the time people think it was overnight.
Yeah.
They were just so lucky.
Right.
And nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have people tell me I'm so lucky.
It's called hard work.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Kristen, you are on episode 3 of the My House Podcast. You were one of our first ones. So welcome back to the studio.
I think this is your first time here because it was via Zoom. I went back and watched this morning.
Oh, that's right.
And it was March 16th of 2022, which is the third ever episode of this show.
And
we should, right at the tail end, we should also acknowledge that Christy Mock is here as well. And you are the local branch manager, correct? Right off of Palmer Wasilla?
Yes.
Awesome.
Very cool.
Perfect.
What a beautiful office that is. I went in, it was like, wow, this is lovely.
We get a lot of pies from there on Thanksgiving. So shout out to your team. It's awesome.
Very cool. And Kristen, you have a 40-year career as a realtor, broker, operating principal, and regional director with over 20 locations across the country. You are the largest individual contributor to the Carson Cottle Project at this time. No organization or foundation has exceeded your donations, except for the HUD grant that was the appropriation to build that building. So
I would love someone in our community to beat me. Right? That would be awesome.
I love that you think that way. That's awesome. And what was it about the My House Project that made you want to support us?
I think in the beginning, I just really connected with the fact that when I was growing up, as I probably said on episode 3, woke up one day and my mom said she was going on a job interview and never came back. And my dad worked on the North Slope. It was back in the day when it was 10 weeks on, 1 week off, and no cell phones or anything. So my dad had no idea what had happened. And we lived in Meadow Lakes, and you could imagine in 1971, Meadow Lakes.
Yikes.
And so we kind of just bounced around with different neighbors, and finally one of the neighbors said, hey, we're going to move to Palmer. Do you want to go with us? Well, what were we going to say? Like, no, we're going to stay here by ourselves. You know, I was 12. My brother was 11. My sister was 13, but she had gone to Nebraska to live with my aunt and uncle. I have no idea why. And that was kind of another thing. Like, why didn't our aunt and uncle take me and my brother too?
Right.
Right. But back then you just, I don't know. I didn't ask questions. I just thought, okay, my sister needs my aunt and uncle. And I just thought my brother and I will be fine. And so we moved to Palmer with this family. So for a while, we kind of just bounced around. And so we moved to Palmer. And that family, unfortunately, was a very dysfunctional family. And they were physically abusive to my brother. You know, they beat him with whips or ropes and belts. And, you know, if he did anything wrong, forgot to feed his rabbits one day or just anything. So they're abusive to him in that way and very verbally abusive. And when I was a freshman in high school, their own daughter went off to college, and she had confided in me that the dad had been abusive to her. She said, but don't worry, it won't happen to you. Well, as soon as she went to college, right, it started on me. And I just remember in the 10th grade, I'd gone to prom. And when I got home, you know, the mom had gone with the son to look at colleges. And so I was by myself. And it's just one of those reflexes. And I don't remember if I told this story, but it was one of those that was so traumatic because he came in my room and I just thought, I'm going to fight now or never. And I just went berserk, like screaming, yelling, you know, and he was like throwing everything off of the, like, just, I just didn't know what else to do, but just be out of control, like hoping that he'd think I was in cray cray land, you know,
right.
Like, and I just remember exactly what he said to me. He goes, you should never do that when someone's trying to rape you. And I'm thinking, well, I think it was a pretty good decoy, right? So
yeah.
he left. And the next day, while he was at work, I packed up my stuff in my car and went to school, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And that weekend, I was a cheerleader. We went on a road trip, and they stole my car out of the parking lot. Because I was 16, so they had keys to my car, right? And so then you're like, it's just one of those things. It just keeps compounding. You're like, can you do any more, pardon my French, shitty things to me,
right?
And I'm trying so hard. And I just remember going and seeing the high school counselor, you know, and she, I think she knew stuff was going on, and I didn't really tell her exactly what was going on, just I was having trouble, and I was trying to find a place to live, and I listed her house for sale years later, and she told me at the time, you know, your grades were good, you were number three in your class, you were in cheerleading, you were in drama, you were in cross country, you know, you were always at the school, so I just figured you were doing okay. And honestly, that was just my coping mechanism.
Right, right.
And I remember asking you in Arizona, and I have thought about it so many times, and it's true. I ask you, you know, because if kids that are abused don't find, you said it. I said, how did I get out of this? You said someone believed in you. And it was Bob Andres, who owns the Windbreak.
Mm-hmm.
And he became my stepdad. And I just remember when I first met him, there was like a period of 5 years I couldn't even shake a man's hand. Like, could not shake their hand, could not look them in the eye. And Bob was so awesome. He was so private. Like, I just remember, this sounds weird, but I just remember how he would always close the bathroom door just to brush his teeth. And I know that sounds weird, but he was just so conservative and private that it allowed me to start trusting again. And I worked at his restaurant. All of my kids have worked at his restaurant. Christy's worked at his restaurant.
I worked there.
You know, my sister-in-law's worked there. I think anybody in that era worked at the Windbreak.
We all waited tables,
yeah.
Man.
But he really, he not only believed in me in terms of I started to trust, but he also taught me everything I know about finance. You know, back in the day, you know, at 18 years old, who's teaching, you know, who's being taught about bonds and about the inverse relationship between bonds and interest rates and just all of that stuff. But, you know, he poured into me, taught me so much about the restaurant business. When I actually went back to school to get my MBA, I did my thesis. I did my project on the Windbreak and studied like their what their cost of food was. You know, you should never get out of this range or you're not going to make money.
Yeah.
Alcohol, just the whole thing. And I mean, he and I are super, super tight to this day. I always, when I'm home, always go see him because I truly, truly will say that he saved me. because coming back from that, coming back from that kind of trauma was so hard.
Oh, yeah.
Because you just don't trust anything or anyone. And I wanted to go to college really bad. So I worked at the Windbreak and I worked at the Mat Valley Federal Credit Union on Saturdays and just save money. Because I was the first one to ever go to college in my family and went to college. And I think, you know, this, you think, you know, gee, really, this all happened to you? And I'd like to say it didn't, but it did. But when I was a senior, I was coming home from school. I lived off campus, and I was going up the stairs to my boyfriend's dorm room, and somebody came up behind me with a knife and abducted me and raped me. And I remember, you know, to this day, I don't why I said this to him, I have no idea. But I said to him, hey, you know, he led me out to this one place and had me turn around, and he said, do not turn around. You know, I'm going to leave, but do not turn around. And he had a knife. He says, or I will kill you. And I said, I just want you to know this because I don't know why, but I want you to know that at some point, if you ask Jesus to forgive you for this, he will. Where that came from to this day, I've thought about it a lot. And I think where it came from is God knew that at some point in his life, he was going to want to be forgiven, but would have no way to locate me or find me to ask for forgiveness. And so I think God just had me tell him right then and there, you know, that's the only thing I can think of. And I remember going to the hospital, and I remember they called it the STAR unit, came in to talk to me. And they talked to me, you know, even it was during finals week. And they said the chance of finding the person, because the guy did tell me he was in one of my classes, and he said that, you know, University of Arizona, I had 300 people in my class. And he just said, you know, the chances of us finding him, especially during final week, everybody's going home, is slim. You know, I just said, okay. And I remember trying to call back here to Wasilla and call my sister, but she was having a baby, so I couldn't get a hold of my sister. So I just remember sitting there in the hospital thinking, okay, this happened and it sucks and it's really bad. But I remember them, this is so bad, giving me a pill.
Yeah.
You know, at the time I'm 20 years old, you know, you just, this sounds terrible, but you do what the doctor tells you, right? And I came back home. Before I came back home, I met with the police again, and they said, we really think you need to stay here in Tucson because you are clearly traumatized. I said, why? They said, because you're normal. So clearly you must be in shock because somehow you're just not freaking out. You're not like, they said, this is just not normal behavior. And I think what it was is it was the normal behavior I'd learned to cope. Mm-hmm. So it was my coping mechanism. And I even remember, you know, when I got back here and I had reconciled with my mom and talked to my mom, nobody wanted to talk about it. And my mom later on said, well, I thought if you didn't talk about it, it meant you're okay. Isn't that crazy?
Oh gosh, yeah.
So she thought we don't talk about it, then everything must be okay.
Yeah.
So I literally didn't talk about it for years. But I remember it was after my daughter was born, Christy, and I just thought to myself, what if this guy still lives in Palmer were to do this to someone else? And I contacted the state troopers and I said, I want to come in. I want to tell you my story. They said, well, you know, the statute of limitations has expired. I said, but it's not about that.
Yeah.
He still lives in your community. And if any other person comes forward and says that he has attacked them, I want you to have this on the record to take them seriously. But because back then, and I'm sure there's many listeners that can appreciate this, I would think about how many ways I could kill him. No, I'm dead serious. Like, I would think.
I totally believe you.
I would think, what if I could like stab him to death? Like, isn't that terrible?
No, or, it's called a revenge fantasy. It's perfectly normal, actually.
You're right. And I thought, what if I could like shoot him?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what happened is I actually got saved, and by learning the Bible, I learned that there was nothing I could want bad enough for him that was going to be worse than the punishment that God was going to give him if he didn't turn from his wicked ways. You know, God said it'd be better for you to have a millstone thrown around your neck and thrown into the sea than to hurt one of my little ones. He was talking about me.
Yes.
And so it was the day I came to the realization there was nothing I could do to him that was going to be as bad as the judgment of God if he did not turn from that terrible wickedness. And it kind of gave me peace to understand that I didn't have to kill him.
No.
That either A, he was going to get saved, because all of us are sinners, yeah, you know, saved by grace, or he was going to die and go straight to freaking hell, and right, it was going to be terrible.
And vengeance belongs to God.
It does. So that was kind of what allowed me to move on, because up until that point, I literally thought about it a lot, mm-hmm, which I'm sure a lot of people do. Once they kind of get out of it and they realize how much someone with authority had control over them, mm-hmm, and the fear that you live in was so awful. So I that really was a big release for me. And then, of course, then having Bob in my life ever since I was 18 years old, Bob's been in my life, and, you know, just somebody who believed in me and told me how smart I was, and really, I would say today gave me my faith back in men. And so for me, that's a very long way to say, when I heard about my house, I remember the first year, I think we only donated like $2,500. But then we decided to really make each closing that we did to kind of set aside money. I think the next year it was like $7,500.
It was a lot.
And for us, it was a lot of money.
It was for us too.
For our company.
Right.
And I remember when you guys, the kids, their gas cards in the safe got robbed.
Yep.
And I told our accountant at the time, I said, write a check for $5,000 and take. Yep. I said, this isn't going to solve their problem, but it'll get the kids, it'll get them gas money and food to get to school. And, you know, it was like the most we could do.
Right.
Right.
I remember you calling and telling me that it's not going to solve the problem, but it'll get them from point A to point B.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the reason I so aligned with you was because there was nothing to help me back, mm-hmm, then. And I just didn't want another kid.
I get it. The whole reason that I started this, and my husband stood behind me for years trying to build a house. I still live in a walkout basement that we built 15 years ago, because all of our extra income went to this, and I feel the same way. It isn't necessary. I want our community to be better. We don't treat children like objects. We don't put them in harm's way. We don't not protect them. And we've really created a network, not just across the valley, but across Alaska, that has resources and stopgaps and transportation and ways of getting kids into safety, into housing. We have 42 beds of housing right now.
Who can keep track? Three more now for treatment.
Yeah,
so
I think it's 42 beds of housing, and we have 64 more in that building, and that will be more beds than Anchorage has for homeless kids. We'll have the 16-bed recovery unit for trauma. We'll have places where kids can come if they're suicidal. They can come and just take a breather, and doctors and people that can come and help them. We have a terrific partnership with Matsu Regional. So kids that are coming out of medical situations, sexual assault response team, suicide holds can come into the program if it's not safe for them to go back to where they were staying, back to their home. We have to have safety. We have to have places for kids to be able to say, I can't do that anymore. I need safety, and have it available right then. We can't say, oh, we don't have a bed open right now, but right. maybe we'll have one in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
We just had that with our treatment program. We had a 9-bed treatment program, and right before Christmas, it filled up. And I was like, oh, no, this is bad. We don't, with fentanyl out there, we don't want a full treatment program and kids on a wait list. They die on a wait list. So we did this crazy thing where we leased this house, this, I don't know, 5-bedroom house out in Big Lake, 5 or 6
it's
bedrooms.
A big house.
It's a big house. Put 12, it moved it out there, and now we have room for 12 kids. So we're going to keep expanding to meet those needs so that they're not in danger.
And Kristen, I think something that is really important that you just touched on is Michelle had me read the Resilience Breakthrough. Something that's talked about in that book is that idea that, you know, you just need that one trusted adult in your life that believes in you. And that's why a core piece of our philosophy of care is that you are valued. You know, every person that walks into the building is valued. And what you have done through your support is create a place where the homeless and at-risk youth of the MATSU and the state have that person in their life, that this becomes their community, this becomes the place where they feel that and they're provided with that so that they can go achieve their potential. And I think that that's how we transform our communities.
Isaac, what's the statistic that that came out of that conversation from the MATSU Health Foundation when they surveyed kids here?
Really great. And I'll shout out to Telsha and Jesse. Well, there's like 3 Jessies over there. So Jesse Burbeck specifically and Rachel, who did community surveys for the Health Foundation's recent health needs assessment. They talked with, I believe, 5 clients of My House when they were in the building. And one of them came up to me, one of the folks from their community team came up to me and said, it's incredible, you know, these conversations, because your clients were some of the only people that I talked to that said that the number one thing they appreciate about the MATSU is the community. In fact, many of the other people that we polled said that they felt disconnected, that they didn't feel that. But every single one of your clients, the thing that they stress the most is that they love the community out here. And she told me that, you know, I think that the reason why is because you've built that community for them,
that
this is their community.
And I think that is what makes such a huge difference, because for whatever reason in the 1970s, like you didn't really even tell anybody. It was like, it was shameful to even speak of something like that. And so you were almost... like, you knew if you even said anything about it, like, people were going to look at you different.
Right.
So you just didn't. You just sucked it up and just dealt with it. And most of the time, like you said, if there's not somebody really that is that one person in your life, it ends up just generational, and it doesn't stop. And it, you know, people end up totally, mental health issues over it and don't recover. So I remember, you know, you say you need one person in the victim's life. And I think also, you know, shout out to our mayor, you know, at the time, Bert, who really was in your corner. And
oh,
I remember
gosh.
You came to me and you said, or actually Bert did. And he said, Kristen, with what you're doing as a business, by you participating and working with My House, it is taking a burden off of the city. He said, so if you will help them raise, I think you needed $50,000 to buy your building, right?
Yep.
And you said, if you will help them raise this money, I will get on the air in the month of December and I will give a shout out to your real estate company. I said, deal, deal. And he was awesome. He was so supportive of you. And like, I needed that one person. I think you did too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Bert was a champion for us in so many ways. He said so many different things over the years. These are our kids. These kids in this community belong to all of us. We take care of them. He just had a focus that included everyone. You know, it was safety, but it was also participation, and it was loving on him. He would come here every day before he went home from work, just about, from the mayor's office, and check in with everybody in the building. And
so cool.
I just thought that was so sweet. His wife is now on our board, Kathy, or his widow. And we talk about him regularly because he had that kind of impact. Mm-hmm. You have that kind of impact. I sat next to John Maxwell at the dinner for your event that was in Scottsdale that we traveled down to. And I was just so tickled to sit there and watch so many people honoring your journey. And John Maxwell telling funny stories. And, I mean, he makes everybody laugh all the time. Mm-hmm. But he was making people laugh while he was edifying you. And it was so, I was so impressed with that. And I was so proud of you, if I can say that. Because I think your story is such a story of overcoming. And not just overcoming, but utilizing what you experienced to make change in the world and make change in the community. And thank you for that. Thank you for not falling into that pattern of, you know, repeated just being in survival mode, you know. And thank you for walking this out with us and being there with us. It's,
you know,
huge.
I have to also give a big shout out to my brother, because my brother, you know, he will say we've done life together. And a lot of people sometimes, you know, are, my brother and I have a very special bond, because when you go through that trauma together,
oh, man.
And you're relying on him and he's relying on me, that's just such a strong bond. And I'm super happy that, because my brother and I had such a great relationship and do to this day, that my kids somehow, we instilled it in our kids, and his children and my children all are super, super, super tight and super close, which doesn't always happen. And I think it's because my brother and I really walk that out our whole lives, of how important it is to have family by your side, no matter what, no matter what,
yeah.
You know, we can, there's just going to be crap that happens in this world, and having people that you can depend on, especially family. And to me, my house is part of my family, because, and you and I have, you know, over the years when we've gotten to talk and you've gotten to tell me some of the obstacles that you've had to go through, it just makes me even more passionate about, like, really? Just watch this. Like,
yeah.
That's how I feel, like, really? And I remember, so we raised the most amount of money that we had ever raised for you guys, and you know, we just had it sitting there in our bank account. And you know, I remember when you called and you said, hey, we need unrestricted funds, right now.
Yep.
I'm like, great, come over and pick up a check.
Yeah.
Right?
It's amazing.
Yeah. So it gives me such, Christy and I mean, we both work really hard in our business. We both set aside, you know, we're setting aside money all the time, as well as doing those fundraisers. And you know, it's not often that you get John Maxwell to fly across the country to speak at your event,
right?
And so it's and the time that we raised the $50,000, John Maxwell was $20,000 of that, by the way.
Wow.
He gave me $20,000.
Wow.
So for us to, you know, it's like, it's one thing to see what's going on in your community and like, oh well, the government will take care of it, or someone else will do something. And I think all of us just do what we can. Time, money, volunteer. Like, there's not any one thing that's more valuable than another. It just so happens that I've been given a different gift. And so I might not have all the time in the world, but I'm pretty good at raising money and making
yes,
money.
You are.
So that's where Christy and I can participate. And so, and there's a need for all of that. There's a need for volunteers. There's a need for you know, other resources, time, people to spend their time, and all the donations matter. I don't think people realize that, you know, when you get government funding, you are also restricted on what that money can pay for and what it can't. And
yeah.
So when you have businesses donating, that money becomes unrestricted funds that can be used for whatever you need it, like whatever you need it for at the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the the business community can have such a greater impact that they have any idea. Mm-hmm. And it all started with a super small little amount, and just over time, you know, I'm super grateful that we've been able to participate at the level we are. We got to go see the building today, which just is so beautiful.
Isn't it something?
Like, if I was that kid back then, you know, today, and to be able to go to that building and not feel like I'm in a treatment center.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
So awesome. So what you guys are doing is just remarkable.
And
I'm so glad that we just get to be a part of it.
Oh, thank you for being a part of it and for your ongoing encouragement. I know I've called you a couple times and just said, I'm so frustrated. And you're just like, just keep going. Just keep going. And I think that's a mantra, right? Among successful
yeah.
people, you just keep going. And
I think successful people have more obstacles than they do wins. And it's the obstacles that really help us figure out a way to wire around the bad stuff.
That's the truth.
And some of the stories you've told me, I'm like, I've asked you, how on God's green earth do you get up and do it again mm-hmm. and again and again? But you do.
Yeah.
And that's, it makes it easy to want to partner with you because I see how hard you're working. You know, you haven't been without obstacles and trauma in your life. I mean, your husband passed away a year ago. You know, and you didn't go, oh, I'm going to curl up in a ball and quit doing what I'm doing. That was, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, don't imagine it.
It's trauma.
It's terrible. But he would not have wanted me to do that. It was tempting. I have days still where it's like, ugh, this is hard. But I have people like you. I feel honored that you've trusted us with your donations and with the care of the youth in our community that represent you, you know, and your journey. And so how could I quit? How could I quit that? It matters more than, you know, grief. Grief,
yeah.
You walk through grief no matter what you do. I'm going to feel that no matter what I do. I'm going to experience that no matter what I do. Why wouldn't I come here and do the right thing? And
I think sometimes it's, you have to really set aside, it doesn't matter how I feel, it does matter what I do.
Yes.
And, you know, I've got to come here and see the successes of the kids that actually come back and work here. It just makes me happy to see that kids that were in my situation today and maybe didn't, that now they do have a place that they can come where someone like you is going to believe in them and they do have a way out. And you know the statistics better than me, but with all of that happens before they're 21, if they get a skill set, can get a job and have someone believe in them, they're going to make it.
Yeah.
They're going to make it. And I think it's unbelievable to me that right here in Wesselo, Alaska, we can have as much homeless youth as we have. So if we have that here, we have it everywhere.
Yes.
And I can't participate everywhere, but you can participate in your own community.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just super glad that we are and will. And seeing what you're doing that started so small, like everything.
It did.
I hope it becomes a model for other small cities like ours of what can be possible, because you've heard the word no more than a few times. So
sorry.
Right? But isn't it encouraging when you do wire around the bad stuff and you see the success? I mean, I'm even marveling at you just spending some time with you today, Isaac, like how much you know, how far you've come and how much you understand the obstacles and how to get around them.
I think every no that we've heard, as much as it hurt in the moment, as frustrating as it was, when you're able to use that as an opportunity to figure out the solution around that no, it has made us stronger, and it's been for the better of this organization as a whole. So thank you to everyone that's told us no for 15 years, because now we are a much better organization for it.
I'll say one more thing, because there's a gal that works on my team in Arizona, and she had quite a bit of trauma in her life before she even fairly recently before she joined our organization, which was, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. And she now gives a portion of every single one of her commission checks to our organization, which allows us to donate to you. And she just gave us, I was telling Joe the other day, she just gave us a donation yesterday or the day before. It was like $500. And so it just becomes bigger than you. People want to be part of something that is solving a big problem.
Yeah.
And when you've been that person, you so want to participate in being part of a solution instead of just going, somebody's going to figure it out, but actually do, like, for her, it I'm sure it's cathartic even, because it makes you feel like, okay, I am being part of the solution. I don't have to be a victim anymore, and I can help other people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've got a young lady that writes a $25 check every month to us, and she sometimes will stick a little note in there and say, I know it's not much, but it makes me feel like I'm giving back and part of something good that can happen, that helped me, that this is something that helped me, and I want to give back. And when we do our radio marathon, I'm consistently blown away by the number of former clients that call in and donate. And I'll get on the phone and say, this is to raise money for for programs. And they're like, yeah, but I want to give. And I think you're exactly right. It's cathartic, it's healing, and it creates in the community a sense that we're all in this together, which we really are.
We really are. And I'm just super excited about just what I'm seeing. It's really special. And it really flies in the face of people who just said it couldn't be done or can't be done, or we're not going to support it because of this or that. And it's like, we're going to do it anyway. Yeah. We're going to find a way.
Yeah. I've experienced a lot of misogyny and people having challenges with a woman at the helm.
Oh, boy.
We could do a whole separate podcast on that.
We could.
And we maybe should sometime.
That would be fun.
But I think that's been another, exercise in dealing with the no's and just, hide and watch. Just hide and watch. Because if I tell you that I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. It may not always happen in the time frame that we think it will, but by God, it happens. And so I'm super excited about sharing the building opening with you. We're looking at a ribbon cutting in December. We're working on the cafe and the auditorium and a music festival to go with that. And so we'll keep you posted and you'll be included in all those events. And
that'll be fun.
We can really celebrate as a community having some spaces and some of the things that really our clients visioned. But in some ways, I feel like it's representative of you and I and things that were not here when we were younger.
Absolutely.
That we wanted.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
These kids want the same things that we wanted.
Yeah, they really deserve a chance to have it.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. The My House podcast is recorded at the My House studio in Wasilla, Alaska. Our producer and editor is Ozzie Keener. For Isaac Smolden, and I'm Michelle Overstreet. Thank you, Kristen. Until next time.